Elementary music teacher friend, you love what you do, but you might feel unappreciated and, in fact, unseen some days. You may even feel like you're on a music teacher island and just want to connect with other music teachers who can relate to both your struggles and wins when it comes to teaching elementary music. I get you and understand completely the feelings you're having. That's why each and every week, the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast will provide you with solo and guest episodes that will help you realize you're not alone in your music teaching journey. Throughout each episode, my goal is for you to be able to walk away with actionable steps and ideas to help you feel like you're ready to take on the new week with whatever challenges may be thrown your way. Hi, I'm your host, Jessica Paresta, and I'm so glad you're here. Whether you're at home, in your car, in the shower, or wherever else you're listening, grab your cup of coffee or whatever other beverage is nearby and listen in to the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast.
I'm Chris Nessie, host of Behind the Mic, Voices of the EPN, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. I am joined today by Tiffany English, and we are going to talk about teaching music with the Orff Schulwerk approach. So, Tiffany, I would love for you, first of all, just go ahead and introduce yourself to the listeners and let us know more about yourself.
Okay. Well, hi, everybody. I'm really excited to be here. This podcast, because I get to talk about my favorite thing, which is Orff Schulwerk. I live in Georgia. Hopefully my accent is not too crazy, but I retired from teaching this past May in 2023 after teaching elementary general music and choir for 29 years. So a lot of experience there. And I first learned about Orff Schulwerk, I believe, in my second year of teaching. So my first 2 years of teaching were not terrible. Like nothing bad happened, you know, school didn't burn down or anything like that. But I really felt uncomfortable. I didn't know what to do. The children, bless their little hearts, they went along with the ride, but I didn't really know what I was doing. So I had a friend who took me to an Orff workshop, and here we are. Fun times with kids and a lot of great learning in my classroom.
That's amazing. How exciting. I feel you on that. When you first get your first teaching position, you know, you have your music education degree in hand and you kind of sort of know what you're doing. Not really, let's be honest, but you just maybe came out of a student teaching experience and then you're like, okay, I'll just kind of follow some of the plans they gave me or things I learned in college. But you just don't realize how unprepared you are until you get in there and do it. do you agree with that?
Completely, 100%. And I had one other little issue I thought, like probably most people, that I was going to be a band director or a choral director, an orchestra director, depending on whatever your jam is. But I thought I was going to be a middle school band director. So I did my student teaching in middle school band. And then, like a lot of people, I got married and we needed two incomes and I was poor and all the band jobs were too far away. And so I just took an elementary job basically for the salary. And I figured, oh, I'll just jump, you know, in a couple years or a year and find a different job. But what happened was that I fell in love with it, and that was unexpected. I didn't think that this was going to be where I wanted to land, and it really was. So if you're listening to this podcast and you think you're going to be a band director or a choir director or orchestra director, please don't discount elementary music. It is so fascinating how children learn and what they can do and how they can be creative. I never regretted it one minute, you know, not moving on. It was a great decision. Yeah.
I was going to say, I've had that conversation so many times where you think you're going to do this and then lo and behold, I was the same situation, thought I would teach band and graduated in the middle of the school year. And the only position open was an elementary music job. And I was like, well, I'll just take this until something better comes along. And then that was the better thing. I ended up loving it. So it's just so funny how our journeys take us. But back to the Orff Schulwerk conversation, it was the same for me. I remember in my elementary music methods course, kind of skimming the surface of all the different, you know, philosophies and teaching approaches and things, but you didn't really understand the differences until you kind of get in there and see it. And it was my district that offered some workshops to kind of introduce you to Orff. And then I was like, what is this Orff thing? And then, oh,
I kind of dig this. I kind of want to get into it more. And so I think that's good advice for maybe a new music teacher listening is like, how do I feel stuck or I don't know how to move forward. And I think it's okay just to kind of get in there and get your feet wet. And then you can find out, you know, the different things offered in your area.
Yeah, agreed. I remember in college, our music methods or whatever people call it, different things, but Orff and Kodai and Dalcroze and all of these brilliant people were just names on the page. We turned the page, we talked about them, and then we turned the next page. You know, there was no active play with this. Like, we didn't really do it. We just talked about it. So that was a disservice to me at first because I didn't realize how interesting it was. I just thought, oh, they're dead white guys, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it wasn't really interesting.
Yeah. So. And like, how does this relate to me and why do I need to care about it? Yeah, it's so true. Okay. So we're obviously talking about the Orff-Scholl work approach. And so can you just, and I know everybody has a general, not everybody, I don't want to label everyone in the world, but maybe has a general understanding of what Orff-Scholl work is. But for those who maybe don't, would you kind of just give us your description of it?
Yeah, sure. Sometimes I find that discussing what Orff-Scholl work is helpful if you know what it's not. Mm. It is not a method. It doesn't have steps, like, you know, do step one, step two. And that can be incredibly exciting because you get to put your own spin on it, or it can be really intimidating because you may not know where to start. The other thing that I like to tell people that it is not instruments. So many people think that Orff-Scholl work is all about the borrowed instruments, the lovely things that Karl Orff invented for our children, but that's not what it is. Orff-Scholl work is an approach to teaching. It's how you think about the material and the concepts and the skills that you want to deliver to children. Orff lessons can be all day long for 29 years with no instruments, and you are still an Orff teacher. It really is an approach to teaching. So I like to tell people that it's sort of like teaching kids language, how they learn language. You know, when they're little and they're toddlers and they're running around making all the sounds and kind of coming up with their own words and learning how to put those words together. And then they learn how to speak sentences and then larger ideas that make sense to them. And then when they're ready, they learn their letters and their, you know, how to read. And then they learn to write and so forth and so on. Orff-Scholl work works the same way in that we allow the kids to really explore and to experiment with sounds and concepts and ideas. And then as they develop that skill level and that idea, that conceptual awareness, then we label things and then we go to notation. So many people think that Orff teachers don't teach notation. Mm-hmm. That is not true. My kids could sight read the spots off a page. And the reason they could is that we started so early with what it is. You know, kindergartners, a lot of people teach rhythmic reading to kindergartners, and I'm probably going to get some hate mail for this, but I just don't think that's right because they don't know what pulse is. Hmm. You know, how do you teach notation and duration if they don't get what pulse is? You know, so it takes a while to get those underlying skills taught. But then once you do and you start teaching them notation, they learn it so fast because they know what it means. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, a lot about Orff-Scholl work, and I could talk about that for a long time, but the elevator speech is, it is an active, joyful way of making music that puts small elemental bits together into a larger musical idea. You know, and another thing to think about is just because it says Orff-Scholl work on the cover of the book, that doesn't make it Orff-Scholl work. Open it and it's got all these accidentals and crazy chord changes and no repeated patterns. It's not Orff-Scholl work. So you do have to kind of know what to look for when you look for materials as well.
Absolutely. I love your definition, and I think that was so well put, and I have not heard it described that way. You're right. So many teachers just maybe think of it as the instruments, and I like to call them mallet instruments because same. I started out my teaching career without any instruments, but then I took my first Orff level and then realized, oh, I could totally do and implement a lot of these things I learned even without a single instrument. Instruments are nice, but I like to say that too. It's kind of like the icing on the cake. You could teach all 6 years of, you know, kindergarten through fifth graders without a single instrument. Now, I think it's great having instruments and I think it's beneficial for sure, but the kids are learning music whether they have it or not. And so I love that you differentiated that and also talked about how your students still learn how to read rhythms. And it's like, I feel like there is a disconnect between, you know, Kodai, Orff maybe, But when you do start really kind of diving into the approach and taking levels courses or even just attending some workshops to learn more about it, you realize how much, oh, there's a lot I didn't know about this, or I have wrong assumptions. And so I love that. I love your description of it. And you mentioned this a little bit, but I would love to hear about, you know, your kindergartners and then all the way through fifth or sixth or whatever grade level you see. How do you use or how do you make those decisions? Because like you said, it's not told in step-by-step format. It is a lot of you making the decision of how I'm going to teach my students based upon their grade level, but also my knowledge. So just give us some ideas of how you use ORF approach with the different grade levels that you see.
Okay. I do want to say a couple of things. First of all, ORF Schulwerk, if you think about planning your lessons like sewing, you know, it really makes a lot of sense. If you pull the thread from this lesson and then sew it to the next lesson and then sew it and can think of this continual thread through your scopes and sequences, mm-hmm. it makes so much more sense. Like it might be that I take a strand of pulse and then I want to pull in duration. And I'm talking about kindergarten right here. So we're going to do some steady beat for, you know, 100 years like you do with kindergarten. And then we're going to talk about duration. So now we're getting a little bit more of different pulse ideas. Now I might pull that into some subdivision. Now I might pull it into where they're creating patterns with their bodies, maybe body percussion, those kinds of things. And a similar idea with your upper grade kids. You know, you're probably going to start with some kind of complicated pattern, maybe a syncopated pattern or some kind of rhythmic idea that you want them to know how to read. And then you use that as your initial building block. And then as you move through the lessons, they are starting to compose with that, maybe improvise with it. Maybe they're creating a folk dance and they have to use that rhythm somewhere in the middle of it. You know, it's kind of like Tetris. You find the blank spots in the kid's knowledge, and then you insert that little extra bit that you want them to know. And it does take time. And it does take a lot of creativity, which is what I love about it. I never was a teacher that really stuck to the textbook because it annoyed me. And I know that that might be, again, I might get a little bit of hate mail about that, but I don't know. But it just seemed to me that that left me as the music teacher out. I just always felt like I, as the teacher, needed that creative side. And I can tell you with 100% certainty, if I hadn't found ORF Schulwerk, I would not still be teaching. No way. And I loved being able to be creative. And that's one of the secrets of planning your lessons and thinking it through K-5. You know, in kindergarten, if they are able to create patterns with their bodies, by the time you have done that over and over, you know, of course, with increasing difficulty, by the time they're in fifth grade, they are doing mixed meter. They are doing all kinds of hemiola things. You know, their drumming patterns are really intricate because they've done that for so long and you've just built it from the bottom to the top. So it does take time. I know so many people today, they love the teachers pay teachers and the different ideas that you find on Pinterest or whatever. And there's certainly a place for that. Absolutely. But I really encourage people to not rely on that solely. Trust yourself, trust your creativity and your musicianship. And you can do so much with your kids if you just believe that you can do it and that they can do it. You know, kids can do anything. They don't know it's hard until you tell them. I do all kinds of things with my kids and it would be really hard and they would never know because I didn't say, guys, this is hard. I would just say, hey, let's try this out. And they go, okay. And then they do it.
Yeah. And it's okay to fail. I know so many times I have thought my kids were maybe ready for a lesson. I'm thinking of even last week. And I got so many confused looks of like, what is she trying to do? I had too many parts or too much going on, or I was moving too fast. And then I take ownership of that and go, okay, it's not that they're not ready. It's that I may be going too fast because I'm too excited. And then they're all like, you know. And so it's okay, though, if you fail. And I think just laugh about that with your students of like, you know what? We're going to continue doing this next week, but we're going to slow it way down. And, you know, I'm just speaking from experience. But also when you were talking, I was thinking about I'm in that place right now at my brand new school. The kids have had music, but not necessarily a formal music education, I would say. And so my kids aren't where I would want them to be, but I'm meeting them. You've already said this, where they're at. And I have to keep reminding myself of that. My kindergartners, I'm laying the foundation building blocks just as I am with my fourth graders, where maybe they're not where my kindergartners will be yet when they're in fourth grade, but they're still getting a good experience in music. And so I get that. I know you probably hear that all the time too, is like, I'm at a new school, or my students aren't where I want them to be, or I want to do more with them, or I see this other teacher's doing this with their students, but I can't because they're not ready yet. It's okay. It's okay to like backtrack a little and do what you can. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. You got to give yourself grace. Mm-hmm. And when things don't go well, teaching is probably, other than maybe brain surgery, teaching is the thing that has the most variables that are uncontrollable. You know, and so it might be that you have this beautiful lesson that, and this happened to me so many times, I can't even tell you. I was so excited. I had this lesson that was going to be brilliant, and the kids are going to be like right here in the palm of my hand. And then the fire alarm went off. Or maybe one of my special needs kids would come in and they were just having a rough day, and that threw the kilter off. Or maybe I had a headache, or maybe I had not really thought about one crucial step. And then you get those looks of the kids are like, oh, we don't know what you're talking about. You know, and those things to me are exciting because then you get to fix it, you know. And then my schedule, I would see I had 8-day rotations. So I would have like 8 different classes in a grade level. And so I always felt bad for my day one kids. I'm like, sorry, y'all. I know this is a sneaky lesson, but we're going to give it a go. And by day 7 or 8, it was lovely, you know. But those are kinds of things where don't beat yourself up. You know, we're trying. And that's what's so fun about orchestral work, is it's really organic. And in the moment, you might drive the bus a completely different direction than you thought you were because of how the kids respond. And, you know, if you've got 8 third grade classes doing this particular lesson, 4 of them might go one way and the other 4 might go the other way. And that's really exciting to me because that lets the kids have that input, and then they will buy in and they will do pretty much anything you ask them once they start getting that musical success. And that's where post-its come in. You got to write down what they did.
Yes.
So that you can remember, because, you know, I would tease them. I'm like, I'm old and I forget things. So we're going to have to figure this out.
Well, especially when you see that many classes, it's impossible to remember who did what and where they are. And it's also okay. I get asked this question all the time too. Like, oh, my classes aren't at the same spot, or they didn't all do the same as that thing. But I remind teachers that just like teachers aren't robots, your students aren't either. They're all going to move at different paces. And like you said, that's exciting. I think it takes a while to feel comfortable with that, of they're not all like the same as that place, because there are, like you said, assemblies, fire alarms will go off, all the things. So learning how to pivot where maybe they didn't get through this whole lesson, but what can I do with them so they still get something out of it? You know, and that just takes time to, like, I don't know, us type A personalities, I'm talking about myself here, that's hard to do. I'm like, oh my gosh.
I was just about to pop in and say, I am one of probably the top 10 anal retentive people in the whole world. So, you know, one thing that I think, especially young or short teachers need to remember, is that it's okay. It took me a long time to let go because I wanted them to do what I wanted them to do. And finally, I had to figure out, you know, Tiffany, you're not allowing them their own learning. You are enforcing your learning on them, meaning my ideas. Like, I wanted them to have such and such a rhythm, or I wanted them to do X, Y, and Z. And that really isn't allowing them to create their own learning. It is forcing them into my cookie cutter shape. So that was hard for me. That probably took me 10 years to just finally let go of that. And that doesn't mean that my behavior management was off the chain. Like, my kids, you know, they knew what was expected. But when I say relax like that, I mean that you allow them so much input and use so much questioning and facilitation in your teaching that they end up somewhere even better than I could ever think of. You know, when I let them go like that, they generally would come up with just unbelievable things. Now, it was messy and it was loud, but that's okay. That's part of the working, you know?
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the sewing example. That really, in my brain, really clicked and made a lot of sense, because it's so true that some teachers, especially our new teachers, which, I mean, I did the same thing. This is no judgment here. This is just what I've seen as well, is it is going to find new lessons all over Teacher Pay Teacher, Instagram, wherever, whatever other websites. And you're just kind of trying to plan each week, and then it's overwhelming. There's really no rhyme to the reason. It's just kind of like, oh, I'll teach this song, but I don't know why. But when you gave that example of look at what you're teaching, like what are the standards and concepts, and then you're connecting them and then you're building upon them. And then even the example of Tetris, that made, I love visuals. And so that made so much sense to me because you basically go back to what did you do the week before? And are they ready to sew into the new, I don't know, piece of clothing, you know, or do they need to stay there, you know? And so going, I just thought that was a good example you gave.
Well, you know, and one thing I also have learned over my advanced years of teaching is when I first started teaching, I bought this planner that had boxes, you know, like Monday box and Tuesday box, whatever. And I really got stuck in, it has to be in the box. Like we do this thing and then we check off the box and then we come over here and we do this thing. And these two things may or may not be related. And what I found out is that my kids really weren't retaining anything, because I was trying to make them do brand new things every time. And so I found that if I had this idea of sewing and I would take one thing that we had worked on and then I introduce that in a new way in the next lesson, it really helps them to recall and remember, but it also gives them that excitement of something new. So, you know, we're not going to do like the last half of the last lesson because they already know how to do that. But I might take an instrument that we used last time and I might take a rhythm we used last time or a song, and then we do something completely different with the song the next time. Because if you start with something that they know, especially littles, K-1, 2, they love doing things that they know. Mm-hmm. It gives them that sense of security, you know, and then taking it to the next place. You know, a lot of times I think people try to just fire hose the kids because they don't see them very much. I mean, I taught my kids twice a month because of my crazy schedule. So I really had to be efficient. And I had to use every second. And that's why that threading thing started happening, because I would be spending, you know, 10 minutes reviewing because they had no idea what I was talking about. But taking that little bit from lesson to lesson really helped me with that retention with them. Mm-hmm.
You may have already touched on this, but a music teacher who's dipped their feet into ORF, or maybe they've already taken a couple workshops or whatever else, but they're still not really sure how to get started. Is there any advice you can give around this that maybe you haven't shared already?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me put on my executive director hat. So now in my retirement, I am the executive director of the American ORF Shulwerk Association, which is really awesome because I'm able to give back to this organization that basically saved my career. Mm. And I will tell you that getting involved, you will not be sorry ever. Never, never. It's like people taking piano lessons. Have you ever heard anybody say, oh, man, I wish I'd never learned to play the piano? I mean, nobody says that.
Yeah, no.
Same thing with getting involved in your ORF chapter or your Kodai chapter or whatever, you know, makes you happy there. It makes you grow as a person and makes you grow as a professional. So one thing to do is if you want to find a local chapter, you can go to the AOSA website, which is just www.aosa.org. And there's a link for find your local chapter. If there's not one close to you, which is might be if you live in a rural area, mm-hmm. or if you live, for example, in the DC area, the traffic is so bad, it's hard to get from one side of the city to the other. So if there's not somebody or a chapter local to you, AOSA has so much digital online content. And we do that on purpose for people who are in these situations, or maybe people have young kids, they can't get to workshops, you know, our Saturdays are really precious. But at the same time, we don't want folks not to have the professional development that they need. So there's independent study units, there's professional learning networks, all kinds of things that you can find on that website that is for members, and several publications of different lessons and professional articles and stuff like that. But from a personal standpoint, you know, I would just, you know, jump in with both feet. I wish that I had done it earlier. I kind of knew what ORF was, but I didn't really do anything about it until somebody else took me by the hand and took me to an ORF chapter. So if you're listening to this and you have never heard of this before and you're like, oh, this sounds kind of fun, you know, consider just looking that up, those chapters, and going, or come to a national conference. Mm-hmm. I always say that that's like a Krispy Kreme donut. If you're not from the South, you may not know what that is, but it's
oh, yes.
A glazed donut. And once you have one, you must have more.
Oh my gosh.
And I always think that ORF Shulwerk is like that. And our professional development conference is definitely like that. So, you know, just reach out. And everybody in ORF land, that's what I call it, is so nice and so willing to help. You know, don't feel bad about asking questions. We've all been there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing, is you feel like everybody maybe knows way more than you do, or they're way ahead of you, or they've been doing this for so long that if I ask a question, they're going to look at you like, shouldn't you know the answer? But no, it's just like students. We teach them to have a growth mindset. So asking questions is, you know, like you said, music teachers who have been ahead of you are willing to help. They want to help. They just don't know sometimes you need help unless you ask. And so I love that. And you have a really active Facebook group. That's really helpful as well.
That's great.
And so, or, you know, we all, those of us that have taken it know that imitation, exploration, improvisation, composition, these are big parts of it. And I know for me, when I first started implementing ORF in my classroom and with my students, I got stuck on the, that probably to my personality, my type of personality, on how much of each of those do I do and which one do I do first and how do I know which of, so someone who has a really anal retentive brain like myself, how do you, when you're planning, how do you do that process of figuring out which parts of those pieces to pull out?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, I will take you back to thinking conceptually rather than activity. And I think a lot of young teachers in particular, or, you know, just teachers in general, get stuck in that activity thing. Like, what are they going to do? Turn that on its head and think about what are they going to learn? And that helps you figure out much more which one to start with, how much time to put into each one of those components. You know, if you're thinking activity, then you get stuck in this, well, I need to do this for 10 minutes, and then I need to do this for 20 minutes. Well, if you think that way, instead of conceptually, you may not be meeting the needs of the lesson at all because you're so stuck in this little paradigm. So my thinking is we always start with some kind of exploration. Mm-hmm. And it might just embody a warm-up. It might be that I have a puppet and we play with a puppet for a while, or it might be I have something in the secret box, or it might be that we're just doing body percussion echoes or some kind of exploratory activity that gets their brains thinking about what's coming. As we move through the lesson, those other things will come in. You know, frequently imitation has to happen in pretty much every lesson because they have to know what the yes is. If they don't know what yes is, they can't improvise because they don't know what the structure is. So you're going to have that imitation quite a bit. The composition, that's a really high level thing.
Yeah.
You know, so that's probably, depending on how often you see your kids, that's probably the least amount of things you're doing just because they have to have the beginning part to be able to get there. Now, improvisation in my lessons was pretty frequent. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't tell you exactly a percentage, but, you know, we would improvise movement, or they would improvise body percussion patterns or question and answer, you know, those kinds of things. Because what I was trying to do was give them a chance to create their own part of the music, even if it was a 4-beat pattern. You know, we're not talking like they have to do 32 measures or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, just thinking about it from a conceptual basis, what is it? It's kind of backwards design, which is a thing that people talk about a lot in education. And the same thing with gradual release. Those two things, when they came across at my school, I was like, wait, for sure, it's been doing that for decades. Yes. And they were acting like this was some brand new thing. But, you know, this backwards design idea of getting, all right, what do I want them to do at the end? And then backing up your bus till you get to the beginning. And what components of this paradigm of Borschelwerk do you need to do that? You know, you might imitate the whole time to get them where they want to go. You know, it just kind of depends on your expertise as the teacher, which, like we've talked about, sometimes that can be a little scary because you're not following the textbook. Sometimes you're using your own brain and your own heart and your own creativity to create this experience for children.
Mm-hmm. I relate to you a lot, or I have always felt kind of like the black sheep, where I'm not saying that's you, but like I've never just gone by one thing. I love to pull from multiple different things, but also put my own spin on it. And I give that advice a lot to teachers, where if you're sitting under leadership of whoever and you're sitting in a session at a workshop or whatever it might be, and you hear them give you an idea or a song or do this activity with this book or speech piece or whatever it might be, I always say, don't just scrap the whole idea and think, I can't do that, or my students couldn't do that. But say, maybe they couldn't do it the exact way it was taught, or I was taught to do this, but I have this other song or this other speech piece. Or instead of, like you said, doing it 32 beats, I might just do it 8. So mm-hmm. I think having that, like, I'm a professional, but also putting my own personality spin on stuff, when you take that into your teaching and you're able to reframe some of these ideas, that helps a lot, instead of just seeing things and getting overwhelmed and going, I can't, my kids can't do that. They can, just may need to modify it, and that's okay.
Yeah. And, you know, that is a thing that happens frequently at workshops and conferences of all varieties, because you're in a closed system. You know, you have this presenter who is this master teacher, and you're in a room of great musicians. And so things at workshops and conferences turn out beautifully.
Absolutely.
You know, and then you get with your children who, you know, have probably it's taco day and they're all wound up, and you know, it's like, okay, this is not going to end like I thought it was, you know, and that's okay. That's okay. But what I wanted to say in response to what you said is, you know, that's where we need to trust our own expertise. And you look at a lesson and you analyze it and you know your kids, you know, even if it's your first year at that school, you're enough of a good musician that you can tell if kids are ready to do XYZ concept. You know, you can tell if they're ready to do syncopation or if they still need to do quarter notes. You know, you can tell that. And trusting our own expertise and not comparing ourselves to others is really important. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes music teachers in particular get stuck in this, I have to compare myself to others because we're so, what we do is so public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you that's know, good.
Performances and so forth. And that really is counterproductive to me, you know, because you're, when you close the door and you're with your kids in your classroom, you're going to do what's best for them. And you're going to use your own professionalism and your own musicianship and expertise. And that's where what we do matters. Mm-hmm. Is in that area, and just trusting yourself to do the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So we've talked a lot about orchestral work. Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you want the listeners of this podcast to know?
Oh, that's a good question. There's so many things. I would just say that teaching is hard, and we all know it's hard for many, many reasons. And even if you don't end up reaching out to an orchestral work chapter or AOSA, reach out to somebody. You got to have a network, and you've got to have some people to help you through, because this is not an easy thing that we do every day. But what we do every day is so important. I can't even tell you how important it is. And you know, as music teachers, we all know how our hearts go into this work. And what we want is our children to have their hearts in this work as well. And that makes it difficult. It makes it much harder than teaching math. You know, my math teacher didn't care if I understood it or not. Mm-hmm. But our teachers, we want them to love it like we love it. And to do that, you really have to have some kind of network of people. So, you know, like this podcast is fantastic. You know, things like this where you can listen to other people and connect and, oh, I hadn't thought about that idea, or let me try that, or, oh, that makes me feel good. She talked about the thread, or whatever it is. You know, it's, you're not alone, I think, is an important thing for people to know. And I just want everyone to understand this joy of the show work. It truly is magical. And if you haven't experienced that, you know, I hope you get to, and I am happy to talk to anybody that wants to talk about it. You know, you can reach out to me and email me, and I'm happy to just talk all day.
Yeah. Yeah. So let everybody know where they can email you, and also about the Facebook group I mentioned, and anywhere else you would like to connect with people after this episode.
Yeah, of course. Well, first of all, AOSA.org. That will get you to the AOSA site. And again, like the local chapters and so forth, there is obviously a way to join, and we hope you will join, and you will get so many benefits if you do that. I highly recommend, of course, you know, it's my job, but I really do highly recommend it. And we're on all the socials. So our Facebook page is the American Orchestral Work Discussion Group, and that is an open group. We do have a couple questions that you answer just to make sure that you're not a bot, but there's that. And then we're on Instagram and X and all the things. So please check that out. And then in terms of if you want to contact me, it's really easy. It's just Tiffany, T-I-F-F-A-N-Y at AOSA.org. And I am happy to talk or answer questions or whatever we need.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This has been an amazing conversation, and I appreciate you coming on here.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure. It's nice to talk to you.
Well, hey there. Thank you so much for listening into the Elementary Music Teacher Podcast. There is an exclusive Facebook group just for listeners of this podcast and any elementary music teacher called the Elementary Music Teacher Community Facebook Group. Come on over and join us there, where we have conversations around the podcast episodes and encourage each other each and every week. And also head to my website, thedomesticmusician.com. I have some free resources there that you can download to help you gain traction in your classroom today. as well as the blog and the membership site and all kinds of other goodies to help you keep going in your music teaching journey. I cannot wait to keep connecting with you and encouraging you and spurring you on in your journey of teaching elementary music. Hang in there, have an amazing week, and I will see you soon.